anyway, there were five newspapers in the middle 20s. Two of them were owned by the Oliver interests. They were Republican papers. And Senator Oliver was one of the owners. That was the Morning Gazette Times and the Evening Chronicle Telegraph. Then the Given estate owned the Morning Post and the Evening Sun, which were Democratic papers. And there was a Sunday Post and there was a Sunday Gazette Times. And then Scripps Howard had bought the Pittsburgh Press in 1926. It was the big evening paper, even back then. And they had an evening on Sunday. Now, the Olivers were doing very poorly, and they offered to sell the Gazette Times and Chronicle Telegraph to Mr. Hearst. Well, Mr. Hearst didn't want to buy the Olivers unless he could buy Post and Sun from the Given estate. The Given estate was run, the trustee was Arthur Braun, who was head of the Farmers Bank at that time. Mr. Braun would spend his mornings at the bank and his afternoons at the newspapers. He would not sell to Mr. Hearst. So Mr. Hearst, my father was doing quite a bit of business with Hearst, represented a number of Hearst papers for the sale of National Advertising. So Mr. Hearst came to my father and said, how about your buying the Pittsburgh Morning Post and Evening Sun? And my father said, I don't have the assets to do that, but because I just completed the purchase of the Toledo Blade. And Hearst said, well, I'll put up the money, and we'll combine the Post and the Gazette Times, and you'll have the Post and Gazette Times in the morning, and you can pay me off over a period of time. And I'll have the Evening Sun and the Chronicle Telegraph, which will become the Sun Telegraph, and I'll have the two Sundays. So that would put Hearst in a position where he had an evening and Sunday in direct competition with Scripps Howard, who had an evening and Sunday. And the Post-Gazette was left with six-day morning, which was practically an unknown thing in this country, because mostly mornings had the Sundays. Yeah. Well, my father agreed to that program, and by 1937 had bought Hearst out of the Post-Gazette. And when my father died in 1941, while I was in the Army, I was drafted. I was working in Toledo, and I had gone to Toledo in the fall of 37 after working a little time in my father's office in New York. And then I went to work at the Blade in Toledo in various departments, and I had worked in circulation, advertising, and so forth, and production, and the press room, and the mail room, and so forth.
When did you graduate Yale?
36.
In 1936.
So, my father died while I was drafted in March of 41, and he died on the day that the Hitler attacked the Russians, June 22nd. I remember sitting in their apartment. They had an apartment at the Waldorf then. And I was in the Army at Governor's Island, First Army headquarters. And I was commuting, because it was before Pearl Harbor, and you were allowed to live off post. So I was living with them, and I remember being reading the New York Times headlines that morning of the Nazi invasion of Russia, and the doctor coming out and telling us that my father passed away. So,
had he been ill for a long time?
He had cancer, and it developed very rapidly. But how long he had had it before they discovered it, I don't know. You know, in those days, the identification of various diseases was not the way it is today. And he was obviously a pretty sick man by the time they found it. I know it was inoperable.
Incidentally, you made reference to their apartment at the Waldorf. Did they move into the city?
Oh, well, we always had an apartment in the city during the winter months, always. And he rented in various places. In after 555 Park Avenue, we rented up in 74th and 5th, I believe. And then, because I was away after that in working in Toledo, or I was at college, but anyway, I was working in Toledo, and they took an apartment in the Waldorf Towers, and gave up the 74th Street place. My mother was quite a bit younger than father. She was born in 1883. And
where were they married? In New York?
They were married in New York and spent the weekend in Atlantic City.
Before we leave all your childhood and college days, I want to get back to just one thing that we did not cover. As you were growing up, did you have any religious affiliations?
Yes, I went to Sunday school at Temple Emmanuel in New York for a period. My father was a very religious man, but not particularly interested in organized religion. He used to say, come and say prayers with me every night before I went to sleep. He did teach me to pray, but he was not someone who attended synagogue or anything like that.
Well, you remember.
Now, my mother did. My mother was a little bit more, at least on religious holidays. She would.
You observed the holidays. You observed the holidays.
I wouldn't say so. Not really. Not really. Not. I never experienced a Seder or anything like that at home. No. I would say that basically, you know, I inherited a sort of a feeling for religion, but not for organized religion, and that was pretty much, I guess, my father's influence. My mother was not a person who could explain things to children. She really didn't impart much knowledge to me. I think she could have probably done a better job, but because she had more interest in the Hebrew faith. But she never really imparted very much to me of that.
And what one gets in Sunday school doesn't give you much feeling for the religion either.
No.
Not
really.
Those days. I think today they may. But
and then, of course, I went away to school at 13, and I went to a school that where probably I was one of, well, in those days, one of very few of the Jewish faith. Very few. I remember, two or three, but they were pretty darn cautious about it in those days. Now, the thing has changed a good deal, and I believe there's a Hillel chapter at Hotchkiss.
My nephew's in there.
Oh, yes? Well, it has changed a good deal. And after we're through this, I'll tell you a funny story about it. But anyway, so I'd say I had not a lot of religious training.
When you were in college, were there any of your professors who were outstanding scholars, people with whom you made any very close association?
Oh, yes. There was Dr. Arnold Wolfers, who had left Germany because of the Hitler business and was head of the International Relations Department at Yale. A marvelous man with a very charming wife. And I took a couple of courses with him, and I enjoyed that tremendously. There was an English professor by the name of John Burdan, who I think had some Pittsburgh background.
B-E-R-D-A-N?
Yes. I think his family was in the wholesale food business at one time or something like that. But anyway, he was an expert in the area of Pope and Dryden and Gay and various others of the 18th century, early 18th century. And he was a very interesting man. I remember his final lecture on the age of Pope. He was always weeks behind our reading. He paid very little attention to being current with what we were reading. And he had been lecturing about the Rape of the Lock, which we had read months before. And he got to within 5 minutes of the end of the hour, and he paused, and he said, "Look at all of you," he said, "your long, gangly legs, your huge feet." The Pope was 5'2", and had a club foot, but he had brains, and out he walked. He never waited for the applause of the group or anything. Out he walked. He was a fascinating old boy. He was getting toward retirement, and a very interesting man. There were others that I enjoyed at Yale. Bill Devane. That's D-E-V-A-N-E. He succeeded William Lyon Phelps in teaching Tennyson and Browning. But I was fortunate enough to have him in freshman English. Yale has one very good principle, and that is that every full professor has to teach at least one freshman course. And I was lucky enough to have him in English freshman year. When we read Henry IV, Part One, and he was a roly-poly man, Devane. Well, he acted out Falstaff for us. He made it live. It was absolutely marvelous. I've never forgotten that. And he really made that course very interesting.
Does a great plays too. The history plays are great plays.
Yeah.
Were there any specific organizations or movements at Yale that you were a part of?
Well, I tried out for the Yale Daily News. As I told you, I was a kind of a skinny kid. And it was hard for me because it meant very late nights. We had to go to the printer and edit copy there and be up until 2-3 in the morning. And it was hard. We wrote stories. We did a lot of things. And some of the older boys, I think, were sturdier and could handle it better than I could. One of my classmates who was in the same group, we were called healers, meaning that's HEELERS, which meant that we were trying out for the paper. One of my classmates was John Hersey, who was trying out, and of course his writing skills were somewhat better than mine.
And his writing skills have paid off.
Another very good person in that competition was Jonathan Bingham, who later was a congressman from the New York area. And another one was Richard Moore, who just retired as our ambassador to Ireland. Red Moore was a very bright fellow, very articulate. And it was a tough competition. And they took, at the end of the competition, the board of the Yale Daily News convened to decide who they would accept on the staff, and I was apparently tied for fifth, and they took four, and they told me, and I think his name, I can't remember who the other chap was, I might be making a mistake, but anyway, the two of us, they told, if you come out again, you'll be accepted. Well, it had taken too much out of me, so I didn't go back. He did, and he was accepted on the staff at a later time. I was business manager of a sort of liberal magazine, student publication at Yale, and I got involved with that at some length. I can't remember any other specific organizations that I was involved in.
You finished Yale, and then you went to Toledo.
Now, I finished Yale, and I worked for about a year in my father's office in New York. And I worked with his troubleshooter and business a man named Dan Nickel, NICOLL. And Dan Nickel was sort of a general factotum who had been circulation manager of the New York Mail when my father owned it, and then had joined him at a later time. And Dan Nickel was, in those days, when I graduated, it was the depth of the Depression. And unfortunately, publishers were having to cut costs. Dan Nickel, it fell to Dan Nickel's lot to have to go to these various cities where my father was involved and, do the cutting that was necessary because things were so bad. And I would go along with him and learn about these things and learn about the operations in these towns. Of course, he had Pittsburgh and Toledo, and that at that time the Duluth Herald he owned. And I can't think of he was publishing on a lease from Hearst, the Milwaukee Sentinel.
How long did your father continue with his advertising enterprise?
Oh, it continued until his death, and then we sold that business to the men who had been with him over the years, and it became known as Maloney, Regan, and Schmidt, who were three of the leaders in that organization. And it was the kind of business that we thought that unless we participated in, it was not something that you could run as you could, let's say, a store or a newspaper or something which had assets. This was like a law firm. You know, I mean, these were a group of salesmen. And unless you were going to head up the sales effort, you couldn't very well own the business. They'd soon do what my father did back in 1900, go out on their own. So, because they were carrying the business. So we sold it to them. And while I was in the service, my brother closed the New York office and moved our headquarters to Toledo, where he settled.
Where did your brother go to college?
He went to Yale.
He went to Yale, too?
He went to Hotchkiss and Yale.
He went to Yale.
Yeah. He also did graduate work. He was a chemist, very interested in organic chemistry. And he did some graduate work at Yale, he did some graduate work at Harvard, and he ended up getting a PhD at Columbia.
In his field of chemistry?
In organic chemistry. And he, during World War II, while I was in the service, he had had a skiing injury, and he was not material for the Army. He worked at Mellon Institute under a fellowship by the Chilean nitrate people. And he was... His interest was the synthesis of thyroxin, the product of your thyroid gland.
Did he ever marry?
Oh, yes. He was married. He was married, had one son, then he was divorced and remarried, and had twin sons by his second wife. And his first son is a cinematographer, lives in Vancouver, British Columbia.
His name is?
Cyrus. With doing honor, I guess, to Cyrus Hungerford. Cyrus Paul Block. And then he had these twin boys, John and Alan, A-double-L-A-N. Who are now about 38, maybe 39, I think, this fall.
What do they do?
Hmm?
What do they do?
Well, John is a co-publisher of the Post-Gazette and the Blade. Alan is involved in our electronic area of the business. We've acquired over the years some small television stations, and we're in the cable business in the Toledo area.
And are they married?
He runs that. No, they're single. They're both single. And not.
Cyrus is married.
Cyrus is married, no children. My son Bill is married and has three daughters. They live in Toledo, but he splits his time. He comes here a lot. In fact, he'll be here tomorrow. And he's a co-publisher and on the business side of the Post-Gazette and of the Blade. His three daughters, his oldest daughter just finished her sophomore year at Yale.
Her name is?
Diana. And the middle daughter is Nancy, and the young one is Catherine.
Where do they go to school?
They go to Maumee Country Day School in
Toledo.
In Toledo. And Catherine is I took her to the zoo. I'd been up at meetings in Toledo, and Sunday I took her to the zoo, and it was such a beautiful day, and the place was jammed. They have a wonderful zoo in
it's
Toledo.
It's a wonderful. Well, our zoo, I think, is wonderful.
Yeah, our zoo has come along
a long way in recent years.
Very, very much better.
I was just there a couple of weeks ago.
Where?
In Toledo, a couple of weeks ago.
Were you? And have you ever been to the zoo
yes,
there?
Yes, we went to the zoo.
Oh, did you? Isn't it great?
It's wonderful.
It's a wonderful zoo. You know, a business writer for the Blade, Frank Skelton, bludgeoned all of the contractors and supply people in Toledo for materials. And the WPA built most of the Works Progress Administration, mm-hmm. built most of those buildings. And he cadged all this brick and whatever was needed. And, you know, they built some wonderful buildings. Now, of course, they've destroyed some of them and rebuilt some. And things, you know, have developed. The one advantage Toledo has is they have a special tax, which goes to the zoo. And the zoo has a base of revenue from a tax.
So they can expand.
So at least you know they're stable, mm-hmm. and then they can use their private funds you know for expansion purposes. Pittsburgh it looks as if the city is going to abandon them,
yeah,
and there's no other tax base for them, and how you can operate that. As a private institution supported by the Zoological Society will be a very challenge. Yes, a big challenge.
The same thing is true of the aviary and Phipps Conservatory.
Oh, absolutely. And we ought to have some kind of regional tax to help cover all of that.
I'll support that 100%.
Or the county ought to absorb the whole park system. You ought to have a metro park system. Have you enjoyed any of the metro parks in Toledo?
I was only to one.
Wildwood, maybe?
I don't remember them.
Oh, they're just marvelous.
Yes, I think it was.
And the walking trails.
Can you start a movement?
Well, yeah, I think it's possible, but you know we're very resistant to change in this area. It's ridiculous for the city of Pittsburgh, which is now, you know, reduced to 400,000 or less, to try to support all these things. I can understand the city wanting to get out of it. They can't do it. They have all they can do to support the police and the emergency medical services and things of that nature, and the fire department, and the public works. We're not realistic about what it takes. People don't want to pay taxes.
Yes, but if it's explained, if it's explained, if you really. If they really understand what it is, they will pay it.
Yeah, if
they
there's
know.
political leadership.
We haven't had leadership in Pittsburgh.
It's possible that Tom Murphy will do it, although he seems to me to be, I think that everything is very simple. You know, he's going to change everything. And he's going to have an awakening, I'm afraid, that it's that easy.
Will he get along with Forster?
Well, I don't know. I don't know. Of course, Sophie
That we know. That's why I asked the question.
And, you know, what a sad thing when we almost had with the legislatures, when the legislature was considering a regional tax, and it looked as if we had it. And then Tom Forster knocks it into a cocked hat and says he's opposed to it. I don't know whether that had to do with his differences with Sophie or what. But anyway, I've never gotten a good explanation of why he suddenly changed his mind about this. But that would have been a lifesaver.
End of side two, tape one, to be continued on tape two.
Well,
that's all that problem.
That doesn't go into.